Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Am I Remembering This Correctly? This is the show where we take a look at some of history's most intriguing people and events. I'm your host, Caleb Giles, and on today's episode, we'll be covering the vital espionage and trickery mission that quite possibly might have virtually won the Allied powers World War II and deemed the British as the class clown, Operation Mincemeat. And before I begin this episode, I do want to just, you know, give myself a little pat on the back. I have officially graduated high school now. Yes, I know I'm amazing. And I am now a college student, which means that my recording studio has been moved to my amazing and luxurious Toyota Camry. You know, everybody give some applause for that. I don't know. Change is different. It's a little weird, but I'm still making the podcast. I'm making it through, which is all we really can do. But, you know, besides all that, let's just get into the episode. So, you know, what was Operation Mincemeat? Well, Operation Mincemeat was a successful British deception operation of the Second World War, otherwise known as, you know, World War II, to disguise the 1943 Allied invasion of Sicily. You see, behind the well-known battles and campaigns of World War II lies a very secret history, and this is the secret of covert operations. Covert operations and deception plans as such were aimed to confuse the enemy at every opportunity. The Operation Mincemeat was a deception plan conceived by British intelligence to fool Germans regarding the true target for the Allied invasion of Sicily. A dead body would be planted, quote-unquote planted, off the coast of Spain carrying secret documents which purported, oh my god, I can't talk today, to reveal that the targets for the forthcoming invasion would be Greece and Sardinia, with Sicily only intended as a feint. To ensure that the Germans swallowed the deception, it was necessary to create a detailed false identity for the body, which was that of a homeless laborer who had died after swallowing rat poison. So, on September 29th, 1939, this was soon after the start of World War II, Admiral John Godfrey, the Director of Naval Intelligence, circulated the Trout Memo. The Trout Memo was basically a paper that compared the deception of an enemy in wartime to fly fishing. Speaking of fly fishing, my favorite teacher that I ever had in high school, he loved fly fishing, and I had no clue what it was before that, so it's only because of him that I know what fly fishing was. So, just, you know, brief shout out right there. Historian Ben McIntyre observes that although the paper was published under Godfrey's name, however, it bore all the hallmarks of Lieutenant Commander Ian Fleming. So, you know, Ian Fleming was like the ghostwriter for the higher ranks. You know, they always stealing the credit. And if the name Ian Fleming sounds familiar to you, it probably should if you're a big spy fan, because he would go on to be the future author of the book series that created the influential spy character James Bond. Yeah, so James Bond originates in World War II, guys. That's interesting. The memo contained a number of schemes to be considered for use against the Axis powers to lure U-boats and German surface ships towards minefields. Number 28 on the list was titled A Suggestion. A corpse dressed as an airman with dispatches in his pockets could be dropped on the coast, supposedly from a parachute that has failed. I understand there is no difficulty in obtaining corpses at the Naval Hospital, but of course it would have to be a fresh one. British intelligence officer Charles Cholmondeley outlined his own variation of the Trout Memo plan, codenamed Trojan Horse. Also, you know, I actually just recently learned that the Trojan Horse operation, you know, that we read about never actually happened. I didn't know that. Now that I know it's fictional, I, you know, kind of feel a little stupid. But I feel a little slighted. You know, like, we shouldn't teach these kids these great stories and they turn out to be false, unfortunately. So Cholmondeley was a flight lieutenant in the Royal Air Force, the RAF, who had been seconded to MI5. MI5 is Britain's domestic counterintelligence and security service thing. He had been appointed as secretary of the 20 committee, a small inter-service interdepartmental intelligence team in charge of double agents. So in November 1942, the 20 committee turned down Cholmondeley's plan as being unworkable, but thought there may have been some potential in the idea. So as there was a naval connection to the plan, John Masterman assigned Edwin Montague, the naval representative, to work with Cholmondeley to develop the plan further. Montague worked under Godfrey at the Naval Intelligence Division, the sub-branch which handled all the counter-espionage work. Godfrey had appointed Montague to oversee all naval deception. Here's what I found. Well, now I'm getting a Wikipedia article about Montague on my Apple Watch, so that's fun. Montague had been briefed on the need for deception operations to aid the Allied war aims in a forthcoming invasion in the Mediterranean area. In late 1942, with Allied success in the North African campaign, military planners turned their attention to the next target, Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was not the target. They turned their attention to the next target. And then Prime Minister Winston Churchill, he wanted to use the Allied forces from North Africa to attack Europe's soft underbelly, as it was called. For this, there were two possible targets for the Allies to attack. The first option was Sicily, which would give them control of the island, and it would also open up the Mediterranean Sea to Allied shipping and allow the invasion of continental Europe through Italy. The second option was to go into Greece and the Balkans to trap the German forces between the British and the American invaders and the Soviets. At the Casablanca Conference in January of 1943, Allied planners agreed on the selection of Sicily, codenamed Operation Husky. That was like one of my vocab words in my 8th grade history class, not to flex. And they decided to undertake the invasion no later than July. There was a little concern among the Allied planners that Sicily was an obvious choice. But Churchill is reputed to have said, everyone but a bloody fool would know that it's Sicily. Adolf Hitler, going to the Germans now, Adolf Hitler was concerned about a Balkan invasion as the area had been the source of raw materials for the German war industry, which included copper, chrome, and oil. The Allies knew of Hitler's fear, and they launched Operation Barclay, a deception operation to play upon his concerns and to mislead Germans into thinking the Balkans were the objective, which diverted resources from Sicily. The deception reinforced German strategic thinking about the likely British target. To suggest the Mediterranean was the target, the Allies set up a headquarters in Cairo, Egypt, for a fictional formation, the 12th Army, consisting of 12 divisions. Military maneuvers were conducted in Syria, with numbers inflated by dummy tanks and armored vehicles to deceive observers. Greek interpreters were recruited, and the Allies stockpiled Greek maps and currencies. Later, Montague and Cholmondeley were assisted by an MI6 representative, Major Frank Foley, as they examined the practicalities of the plan. Montague approached pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury to determine what kind of body they needed and what factors they would need to take into account to fool a Spanish pathologist. Spilsbury informed them that those who died in an air crash often did so from shock and not drowning. The lungs would not necessarily be filled with water. He added that Spaniards, as they are Roman Catholics at this time, were averse to postmortems and did not hold them unless the cause of death was of great importance. Spilsbury advised that a person could have suffered one of many different causes of death which can be misconstrued in an autopsy. This meant that not only would they have a better degree of success than they previously thought, but there would also be a large number of corpses potentially available for selection when the time came. When Montague discussed the possibility of obtaining a corpse with the Bentley purchase, the coroner of the Northern District of London, he was told there would be practical and legal difficulties. So the coroner basically told him, I think bodies are the only commodity that's definitely not in short supply at the moment. You just go pick one up off the battlefield. But even with the bodies all over the place, each one has to be accounted for. Purchase promised to look out for a body that was suitable, though. Later, on January 28th, 1943, Purchase contacted Montague with the news he had located a suitable body. Yay, cheers, everybody. And that body was that of Glyndwr Michael, a man who had become homeless during World War II and who had died from eating rat poison that contained phosphorus after living on the streets of London.
Purchase informed Montague and Cholmondeley that the small amount of poison in the system would not be identified in a body, and that was supposed to have been floating in sea for several days. So, you know, based on how small the amount of poison that killed him and how long it had been in the system and kind of did its thing, if the autopsy was to happen, it's super, you know, unlikely that it would be found. When Montague commented that the undernourished corpse did not look like a fit field officer, Purchase informed him that he does not have to look like an officer, only a staff officer, more used to office work. Purchase agreed to keep the body in the mortuary refrigerator at a temperature of 4 degrees Celsius, or 39 degrees Fahrenheit for, you know, Americans. He warned Montague and Cholmondeley that the body had to be used within 3 months, after which it would have decomposed past the point of usefulness. So, on February 4th of 1943, Montague and Cholmondeley filed their plan for the operation with the 20 Committee. It was a reworking of Cholmondeley's Trojan Horse plan. The mincemeat plan was to place documents on the corpse and then float it off the coast of Spain, whose nominally neutral government was known to cooperate with the ABWE, the German military intelligence organization. The plan was passed by the committee, who had passed it up the chain of command to the senior Allied strategist. Montague and Cholmondeley were ordered to continue with their preparations for the operation. Montague and Cholmondeley began to create a fictitious background and character for the body. The name and rank that was chosen was Captain Acting Major William Martin of the Royal Marines, and he was assigned to the Combined Operations Headquarters. The name Martin that was given to the body was selected because there were several men with that name of about that rank in the Royal Marines. As a Royal Marine, Major Martin came under Admiralty authority, and it would be easy to ensure that all of the official inquiries and messages about his death would be routed to the Naval Intelligence Division. Additionally, Royal Marines would wear battle dress, which was easily attainable and came in standard sizes. The rank of acting major made him senior enough to be entrusted with the sensitive documents, but not so prominent that anyone would expect to know him. To reinforce the impression of Martin being an actual real person and not a dead body, basically the plot of Weekend at Bernie's, Montague and Cholmondeley provided corroborative details to be carried on this person. These included a fake photograph of an invented fiance named Pam. Pam was actually the image of an MI5 clerk, Gene Leslie. Two love letters from Pam were included in the pocket letter, as was a receipt for a diamond engagement ring costing £53 from a Bond Street jewelry shop. Bond Street, later being, you know, helping find the name James Bond. And to ensure that the letters would remain legible after immersion in seawater, Montague asked MI5 scientists to conduct tests on different inks to see which would last longest in the water, and they provided him with a suitable list of popular and available ink brands. Other items of pocket litter that were placed on Martin included a book of stamps, a silver cross, and St. Christopher's medallion, cigarettes, matches, and a pencil stub, keys, and a receipt from Gives for a new shirt were also included. To provide a date that Martin had been in London, ticket stubs from a London theater and a bill for 4 nights lodging at the Naval Military Club were also added. Along with other items placed on him, an itinerary of his activity in London would be constructed from April 18th to April 24th. Multiple attempts were made to photograph the corpse for a naval identity card. However, the results were rather unsatisfactory. Obviously, you're taking a picture of a dead person and they're super pale and everything. Fun fact, though, in France back in the day, taking family portraits with your dead family members was super normal. I mean, they would even have them, at holidays, family dinner sitting at the table, which I hope nobody does that still. That's weird. When faced with this, Montague and Cholmondeley conducted a search for people who resembled the corpse. Their search resulted in them finding Captain Ronnie Reed of the MI5. Reed agreed to be photographed for the identity card wearing a Royal Marine uniform, as the three cards and passes needed to look too new for a long-serving officer. They were issued as recent replacements IDs for lost originals. Montague spent the next few weeks rubbing all three cards on his trousers to provide a used sheen to changing them. So, you know, everybody's out fighting in this battle, and this soldier's pulled off the battlefield, and his only job is to rub this card on his pants. And I guess that's a very honorable way to really serve your country. The main document that was placed on the dead body was a personal letter from Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Nye, the Vice Chief of the Imperial General, to General Sir Harold Alexander, commander of the Anglo-American 18th Army Group in Algeria and Tunisia under General Eisenhower. After several attempts at drafting the document did not generate something that was considered natural, it was suggested that Nye should draw up a letter himself to cover the required points. The letter covered several purportedly sensitive subjects, such as the unwanted award of the Purple Heart by U.S. forces to British servicemen.
I found this on the web.
I know what the Purple Heart is, Siri. I don't need you to tell me.
Okay, if you ever do need me again, just let me know.
Okay.
I'll be here.
Okay, Siri. Siri is always interrupting me. So the letter covered the sensitive subject as the British soldiers not wanting Purple Heart medals that were issued by the U.S. servicemen to the Brigade of Guards. Montague thought the result was quite brilliant. The key part of the letter stated, We have recent information that the Germans have been reinforcing and strengthening their defenses in Greece and Crete, and the Chief of Imperial General Staff felt that our forces for the assault were insufficient. It was agreed by the Chiefs of Staff that the 5th Division should be reinforced by 1 Brigade Group for the assault on the beach south of Cape Araxos, and that a similar reinforcement should be made for the 56th Division at Kalmata. The letter went on to identify Sicily and Dodecanese as cover targets for the assaults, along with justifications for their selection. There was also a letter of introduction from Martin from his putative commanding officer, Vice Admiral Lord Lewis Mountbatten, the Chief of Combined Operations, to Admiral of the Fleet Sir Andrew Cunningham, who was the Commander-in-Chief of Mediterranean Fleet and the Allied Naval Commander in the Mediterranean. Martin was referred to in the letter as an amphibious warfare expert on loan until the assault was over. The document included a clumsy joke about sardines, which Montague inserted in the hope that the Germans would see it as a reference to planned invasion of Sardinia. The key part, however, was that a single black eyelash was placed within the letter to check if the Germans or Spanish had opened it. Which, you know, is... I don't know how they kept track of, like, the eyelash being in there, because it's so small, but it actually turned out to be, like, a huge part of the plan. So the idea is basically they put the eyelash in there, and then when they went to, like, if the letter ever got back to them and returned, and they opened it and the eyelash was gone, they would know somebody had read it and, like, fell for their trick. Montague just considered that there would be a possible Roman Catholic prejudice against tampering with the corpses, which, you know, could lead the Spanish to completely missing the documents that were stored in the corpses' pockets. So they added them to an official briefcase that would not be overlooked. To justify carrying documents in a briefcase, Major Martin was given two proof copies of the official pamphlet. And on combined operations written by the author Hilary Saunders. Then on Mountbatten's staff. Saunders was then on Mountbatten's staff. And a letter from...
Here's what I found.
Oh my lord, Siri. I got this new Apple Watch and my Siri goes off randomly. I don't really know how to fix that. The planning team first thought of having the handle clutched in the corpse's hand and held it in place by a rigor mortis, but the rigor mortis would probably wear off and the briefcase would drift away, and they didn't want that to happen, so therefore they equipped Martin with a leather-covered chain, which was used by bank and jewelry couriers to secure their cases against snatching. The chain was looped around the belt of his trench coat, and it had long been assumed that the western coast of Spain would be the ideal location. Early in the planning, they investigated the possibility of Portuguese and French coasts, but they rejected these in favor of Huelva on the coast of southern Spain. After advice was taken from the hydrographer of the Navy regarding the tides and the currents best suited to ensure the body landed where it was wanted, Montague later outlined that the choice of Huelva was also made because there was a very active German agent who had excellent contacts with certain Spaniards, both officials and others. The agent, Adolf Kloss, not to be confused with Santa Claus, was a member of the Abwehr. And he was the son of a German consul and operated under the cover of an agriculture technician. Haluva was also chosen because the British vice consul in the city, Francis Hazelden, was a reliable and helpful man who could be relied on, according to Montague. On April 13th of 1943, the committee of the chiefs of staff met and agreed that they thought the plan should succeed. Or proceed. And, you know, they probably hoped it would succeed also. The committee informed Colonel John, which controlled the planning and the coordination of deception operations, that he needed to obtain final approval from Churchill. 2 days later, Bevan met with Churchill, who was in bed wearing a dressing gown and smoking a cigar, and in his room at the Cabinet War Offices, and explained the plan. He warned Churchill that there were several aspects that could go wrong, including the Spaniards might pass the corpse back to Britain with the papers unread. Churchill replied that, in that case, we shall have to get the body back and give it another swim. Churchill was a big believer in, if it fails, try again. So, Churchill gave his approval to the operation, but delegated the final confirmation to Eisenhower, whose plan to invade Sicily would be affected by it. Bevan sent an encrypted telegram to Eisenhower's headquarters, requesting final confirmation. Then, in the early hours of April 17th, 1943, the corpse encountered a one-last-minute hitch. The feet had been frozen. And, like, they went to the coroner who kept it frozen and who was, like, talking himself up, talking about how he's going to keep it in this exact temperature. And it turns out that, like, the freezer had, like, a malfunction. And then, so, it was still cold, but it, like, thawed faster when they were trying to put it in the water. So, of course, when they found that the freezer had thawed, they put it in a different one, and then the temperature got messed up and the feet froze. So, with the feet being frozen, Montague and Cholmondeley couldn't put the boots on. So, they had to go find an electric heater, and it was located, and they had to defrost the boots. They had to defrost the feet to put the boots on properly, which wasted a bunch of time. The body was then placed in a canister, which was filled with 21 pounds of dry ice and sealed up. When the dry ice sublimated, it filled the canister with carbon dioxide and drove out any oxygen. This helped preserve the body without refrigeration. On April 19th, the submarine, the Seraph, set sail and arrived just off the coast of Haluva on April 29th, after having been bombed twice en route. After spending the day exploring the coastline at 4:15 on April 30th, the Seraph surfaced. Jewel had the canister brought up on deck, then sent all of his crew below except the officers. They opened the container and reloaded the submarine, and then traveled 12 miles where it surfaced and the empty container was pushed into the water. As it floated, it was riddled with machine gun fire so that it would sink. Because of the air trapped in the insulation, the effort failed and the canister was destroyed with plastic explosives. Jewel afterwards sent a message to Admiralty to say, "Mincemeat complete." The body was found later around 9:30 a.m. on April 30th of 1943 by a local fisherman. From there, it was taken to Haluva by Spanish soldiers. Here at Haluva, the body was handed over to a naval judge. Hazelden, a vice consul, was officially informed by the Spaniards, and he reported back to the Admiralty that the body and briefcase had been found. At midday on May 1st, an autopsy was undertaken on Michael's body. Hazelden was present in order to minimize the possibilities that the two Spanish doctors identified that the body was a three-month-old corpse. Hazelden asked if, in the heat of the day and the smell of the corpse, the doctor should bring the postmortem to a close and, you know, just go have lunch, because there's no way it could have been faked. The doctors, decided, yeah, you're right. They agreed, and they just went ahead and signed the death certificate for Major William Martin on the cause of death for asphyxiation through immersion in the sea, which is a fancy word for drowning. The body was released by the Spanish and was buried in the San Marco section of the Nuestra Senora Cemetery in Haluva with full military honors. Then the Spanish Navy retained the briefcase, however, and despite pressure from Adolf Kloss, neither it nor its concerns were handed over to the Germans. On May 5th, the briefcase was passed to the naval headquarters at San Fernando. Once the briefcase arrived there, it was then sent to Madrid, and its contents became the focus of attention. Carl Ike Kulenthal. He asked Admiral Wilhelm Carnes to personally intervene and persuade the Spanish to surrender their documents. Acceding to the request, the Spanish removed the still damp paper by tightly winding it around a probe into a cylindrical shape and then pulling it out between the envelope flap, which was still closed by a wax seal in the envelope body. The letters were dried and photographed, then soaked in salt water for 24 hours before being reinserted into their envelopes without the eyelash that had been planted there. So all these people, they went and they took pictures of the documents and read it, and they were sending them out to everybody. However, they didn't notice the eyelash when they opened it, and they sent it back without the eyelash. And of course, you know, the Americans were very excited when they got this news back. Let's see. The information was passed to the Germans on May 8th, and this was deemed to be so important by the Abwehr agents in Spain and Kuhnlethal personally took the documents to Germany. On May 11th, complete with the documents, the briefcase was returned to Hausen by the Spanish authorities. He forwarded it to London in the diplomatic bag on receipt. The documents were forensically examined, and the absence of the eyelash was noted. Further tests showed that the fibers in the paper had been damaged by folding more than once, which confirmed that the letters had been extracted and read. Hausen leaked the news to the Spaniards, known to be sympathetic to the Germans. On May 14th, a German communication was decrypted. The message, which had been sent 2 days previously, warned that the invasion was to be in the Balkans, with a feint to Dodecanese. Then, a message was sent by Brigadier Leslie Hollis to the Secretary of the Chiefs of Staff Committee to Churchill, then in the United States. It read, "Mincemeat, swallowed rod, line, and sinker, by the right people from the best information they took, like acting on it." So, the plan went off without a hitch. And not only was the eyelash a determining factor, but even if the eyelash wasn't placed there, whenever the Germans read the letter, they folded it differently and put it back. But, like, everybody knows, Trickery 101, always put things back the way you found them. But on May 14th, 1943, Karl Dönitz met Hitler to discuss a recent visit to Italy, his meeting with Benito Mussolini and the progress of the war. The admiral, referring to mincemeat, recorded, "The Führer does not agree with Mussolini that the most likely invasion point is Sicily. Furthermore, he believes that the discovered Anglo-Saxon order confirms the assumption that the planned attacks will be directed mainly against Sardinia and the Peloponnese." So, even my mans, Hitler and Mussolini, were tricked by this dead body. So, Hitler informed Mussolini that Greece, Sardinia, and Corsica must be defended at all costs, and that German troops would be best placed to do the job. He ordered that the experienced 1st Panzer Division be transferred from France to Salonika, Greece. By the end of June, German troop strength on Sardinia had been doubled to 10,000, with fighter aircraft also based there as support. German torpedo boats were moved from Sicily to the Greek islands in preparation. 7 German divisions transferred to Greece, raising the number present to 8, and 10 were posted to the Balkans. On the 9th of July, the Allies invaded Sicily in Operation Husky for a considerable time after the initial invasion. Hitler was still convinced an attack on the Balkans was imminent, and in late July he sent General Erwin Rommel to Salonika to prepare the defenses of the region. By the time the German high command realized the mistake, it was too late to make a difference. On July 25, 1943, as the battle for Sicily went against the Axis forces, the Italian Grand Council Fascism voted to limit the power of Mussolini and handed the control of Italian armed forces over to King Victor Emmanuel III. The following day, Mussolini met with the king, who dismissed him as prime minister. The former dictator was then imprisoned. A new Italian government took power and began secret negotiations with the Allies. Sicily fell on August 17th after a force of 65,000 Germans held off 400,000 American and British troops long enough to allow many Germans to evacuate the Italian mainland. So, essentially, the Axis powers moved all their forces over to the Balkans and Greece, which left Sicily wide open. And then, American and British troops, they rushed Sicily, and they the battle raged on for a while. And all the Germans ended up retreating as they'd been tricked, and the Americans took over Sicily. And then, you know, the Italian government was basically like, "Mussolini, we don't like you anymore. How could you do this to me? You trusted Hitler over your own Italian intelligence advisors? I don't know. We don't like this new friendship you got here if he's not going to help you out. So then, as everyone knows, the Italians went to Mussolini's prison cell, broke him out, stripped him naked with him and his lover, and hung him on a pole and beat him in the city square. Yes, we love the Italians, and they make pretty great gelato, too. So, you know. Military historian Michael Howard, while describing mincemeat as perhaps the most successful single deception operation of the entire war, considered mincemeat and Barclay to have less impact on the course of Sicily campaign than Hitler's congenital obsession with the Balkans. McIntyre writes that the exact impact of mincemeat is impossible to calculate. Although the British had expected 10,000 killed or wounded in the first week of fighting, only a seventh of that number became casualties. The Navy expected 300 ships would be sunk in action, but they lost 12. The predicted 90-day campaign was now over in 38 days. So, you know, Ian Fleming's just brilliance, and I think to celebrate, we should all go and watch our favorite James Bond movie tonight. Casino Royale? Anybody? Okay. So, now, you know, that's really, really all that happened. I got tripped up on my words right there. It's just another classic tale of the Americans outsmarting the Germans. And Germans have never been on the right side of a war, so they might need to, like, bolster their track record. And, well, that is the closing of our time spent together discussing this real-life spy mission. I have to say, just, you know, for closure, I did write this episode before Netflix made their movie about Operation Mincemeat, but unfortunately, they did beat me on the release date. So you can go watch that if you want to see the story, you know, if you're a visual learner. Anyways, please make sure to follow me on Instagram at AIRTC.podcast for updates and notifications whenever new episodes come out. With that, I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and I hope everyone has an amazing day. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this is Caleb, signing off.